First off, you'll notice that my little title screen here has kind of the wrong title on it. So full confession on my part, I kind of wrote a bit the wrong talk. So this one has two questions. Is revolution possible and what would it look like? Miscommunication on my end, I'm sure. I didn't really realize until I saw the official program. Good news here, though, is you're getting two talks for the price of one, or two questions answered for the price of one. So that's where I'm going. And our little kind of revolutionary journey today starts in Myanmar, where on the 1st of February this year, a military coup sparked a mass popular revolt against the junta, very quickly. In those first few days and then weeks and months, cities and towns right across the country reverberated with a number of really spine-tingling, thrilling revolutionary chants at those daily mass demonstrations. Among the most popular of those chants were three that serve as a good place to start this session. One, return our elected leaders. Two, if you go to work, you support the coup. And the beautifully straightforward third one, our revolution must triumph. Those three chants point at some of the key themes of this session, not in ways, though, that might be immediately obvious to you. So I just want to flag a few things for you to think about as we go. For starters, it's worth noting that those three chants had mass resonance in Myanmar because they expressed the views of the oppressed and exploited classes. That is, they made sense to people across the country in the heat of an uprising. Second, those chants demonstrate a sort of instinctive understanding amongst the rebellious population that the strongest weapon our side has is our ability to withdraw our labor and thereby grind all of society to a halt. And thirdly, the fact that these chants were being raised at all, the content of those chants hints at a debate that was happening and continues to happen in the revolution. It kind of tells us that there are competing politics and ideas within the uprising. What I mean by that is, just consider that question, about the first slogan, return our elected leaders. It refers, of course, to the NLD, the National League for Democracy, for whom the aim of the revolution is limited really to just putting themselves back into power, regardless of whether or not that means fundamentally breaking the grip of the military. So the NLD's vision of human freedom is not the same as the vision held by the millions of people who carry their placards and who get shot at for doing so. Which also means then that third chant, our revolution must triumph, also raises a question. What constitutes a triumph then? What would a successful revolution look like? And so for all those very important and practical and timely reasons, you could do worse than keep Myanmar in mind as we work our way through this topic. If you don't keep it in your mind, I'll be putting it there anyway. So deal with that. As I said, we're dealing with kind of a double barrel question. Is revolution possible and what would it look like? So I'm going to be kind of smooshing those together a bit. And I'm going to give you some accounts from real revolutions in the past and in the present and explain a bit about how those revolutions came about, how revolutions grow out of the existing conditions of society. These are conditions that compel people to move into revolutionary action on a mass scale. And what's more on that, I'd suggest that the inescapable conclusion from any serious study of human history is that revolutions are not only possible, they are inevitable. The only thing that's not inevitable is that any given revolution will be successful. There are difficulties in navigating the fast-moving terrain, difficulties in answering the complex challenges that a revolutionary situation throws down, enormous challenges. So there's no guarantee that any revolution, once it arises, will succeed in overthrowing the old regime and building something new and better in its place. On the contrary, we'd have to say many of the revolutions we've seen in the last decade or so, although it is nice to be able to say many of the revolutions we've seen in the last decade, for those of us who've been around for several decades, but nonetheless, many of the ones we've seen recently have starkly failed in their efforts, often leading to brutal counter-revolutions, the re-establishment of military rule, or worse. So yeah, the first question isn't really just, is revolution possible, but is victory possible? So don't ask if it's possible, ask how we can win, which is part of also the way of answering what it would look like, but we'll get there. The other question lurking beneath the surface of all of this is not so much, is revolution possible in some broad universal sense, some timeless sense, but is it possible outside of countries that are already, you know, horrendous dictatorships? Is revolution possible in a system that's, for example, a liberal parliamentary democracy? Or to stop beating around the bush, is revolution possible here? Can sleepy old Australia be a place where revolution breaks out? At certain times, revolution is in fact possible anywhere because exploitation and oppression are present everywhere, because capitalism with its inherent crises is present everywhere, and because collective organization and collective resistance exist everywhere. And that resistance can burst out in mass radical action anywhere, even here. So revolutions are an inevitable aspect of class-based society. In fact, since the emergence of social classes, revolutions have been the driving force of human history, which is something that Marx pinpointed quite a while ago. All class-based societies have been premised on the exploitation by one class of other classes, the slave owners' exploitation of the slaves, the feudal lords of the serfs, and so on. Every one of those social orders that must at the time have seemed so unshakable, so permanent, so unbeatable, every one of them was eventually faced with being overthrown through revolutions made by the exploited classes. Whole social orders ordained by made-up traditions, by religious customs, by laws, by all of the ideological trappings that evolve from them, whole social orders enshrined for centuries and enforced by the state's monopoly of all the weapons and the deadly force of the time, all of them can be and have been at times swept aside over the centuries by mass uprisings of oppressed people who refuse to tolerate the situation any longer. Capitalism, too, is a class society premised on exploitation, with a capitalist class ruling over a social order that is entirely and inescapably founded on exploitation. History proves decisively that revolutionary situations will arise in which the exploited classes of today rise up against the capitalist class. We've seen that numerous times in the last 150 years or so, most notably in Russia in 1917. But even short of those massive kind of class versus class battles in which the whole structure of society is challenged, like it was in Russia, even short of that, revolutions can and do frequently erupt in what you might call a kind of more modest scale. Because in fact, revolutionary moments can emerge whenever the masses are pushed into revolt. And that in turn can happen through any of the systemic crises that regularly rack the capitalist system. Or it can happen to an attack on democratic spaces like the CCP's continuing encroachment on Hong Kong, or the military coup in Myanmar, or the repeated rigging of elections in Belarus. Under capitalism, there are many crises that can be the immediate catalyst for revolution, and there are many paths a revolution can take. And what's more, there are some key developments that when they do happen, or if they happen, make some revolutions more expansive, more profound, just deeper than others. Let's look, though, at things that are the hallmarks of all revolutions. Firstly, revolutions, because they involve the mass of the population attempting to assert their own collective influence on society at large, tend to rapidly sweep aside all those obstacles and barriers that have kept people down for so long. Look at any revolution that's ever happened, even those that weren't successful, and you will see the same explosive dynamic, an outpouring of creativity, of generosity, of solidarity. You'll see new forms of art emerge, or new ways of doing old art. You'll see singing, dancing, painting, you name it. Especially in the high points of a revolutionary upsurge, you'll see the sheer, unbridled joy as all the oppressed, exploited, downtrodden millions are electrified by the potential that's finally in their grasp. And most importantly, you'll see the marginalized and oppressed sections of society putting themselves at the head of the revolutionary upsurge. This pattern is so common, so frequent, such a hallmark of revolutions, that the leading Bolshevik figure, Lenin, who saw his fair share of revolutions and helped lead history's most important one, he summed it up perfectly. He said, "Revolutions are festivals of the oppressed." a young woman who participated in the Spanish Revolution of 1936 remarked on her experiences sometime later in life, speaking to a film crew. She said, "That revolutionary explosion gave us women absolute freedom. At the time, to be a woman and to be young was the ultimate. It was an extraordinary Barcelona," she said. "Many songs were sung. There'd never been so much singing." We hear almost the same sentiments, you know, word for word, in the reflection of people who participated in the Hungarian Revolution of 1956, that's some 20 years later, and likewise reflecting on their experience later in life to another film crew. One of them said, "Suddenly we felt we had freed ourselves, like in 1848, which was another European revolutionary year, like in 1848, we'd taken our fate into our own hands. It was incredible. When you're 20, it's extraordinary being a part of something like that. It was great to be human." In Tiananmen Square during the 1989 uprising, that sense of mass solidarity, of collective struggle and common purpose was so profound that people spontaneously pooled their resources, setting up communal kitchens, donating food, donating money, and so on. There was so much selflessness, so much generosity, that very quickly a new witty saying emerged and, you know, took root across Beijing. People would say, "Even the thieves are on strike." So nobody who's looked at revolutions throughout history would have been surprised by what we saw in February this year, when the women workers of Myanmar's textile factories were the first workers to come out on strike in defiance of the military junta. It wasn't the middle-class lawyers or the NGOs or the academics or whatever. It was thousands of women with calluses on their hands and scarves in their hair pouring out of the factories to declare, "We are not going to accept the military dictatorship. We are taking matters into our own hands, and everyone else out there better bloody well get out here and join us on the streets." That was, of course, a stark echo of the women textile workers of Mahalla in Egypt, who led the mass strikes in 2006 to 2008, which were in many ways the opening salvo of what was to become the 2011 revolution that brought down Mubarak. The women workers struck in factory after factory, expecting their male workmates to follow. When the men didn't appear, the women marched from factory to factory, chanting, "The women are here, where are the men?" And eventually the men did join them, no doubt with their tails between their legs, and together those workers made history. While the Festival of the Oppressed is a remarkably accurate description, the hard reality is that revolutions will necessarily also involve facing off against the armed forces of the state. One common manifestation of this is workers and students suddenly building barricades. We've seen them in the Paris Commune of 1871, right through to the Myanmar uprising today, where in fact some of the most amazing and serious constructed barricades I've ever seen have been in place throughout this year. It's worth checking out the photos. The Russian revolutionary Leon Trotsky once wrote that the point of barricades in a revolution is not to stop the soldiers, but I mean, honestly, that would be, you know, a very difficult and unequal balance of forces, a difficult task. Rather, Trotsky explains that the main point is to slow the soldiers down long enough that workers and rebels can talk to them, can try to convince them not to shoot, convince them maybe to switch sides. Now, you might think that's far-fetched, but in fact, that exact scenario has happened time and time and time again. The accounts of the Russian Revolution in 1917 often note that dynamic, and in Beijing during the Tiananmen Square uprising, the government had to eventually resort to using soldiers from outside, from other provinces to carry out their bloodbath, because every time they sent local soldiers in, tens and thousands of workers and students and other residents of the city just blockaded the soldiers and harangued them. You can see it here, just harangued the soldiers, convinced them not just to put their weapons down, but in some cases to hand their weapons over to the protesters and defy their own generals and return themselves to the barracks. And yeah, it happened time and time again in the days leading up to the final crackdown. This is a rebellious population driving a wedge into the military itself. It's an amazing kind of moment in history when that happens. So we know that revolutions will involve mass protests, like we've seen in the Arab revolutions and across the more recent rebellions, you know, in various parts of Asia in particular. We know they'll involve oppressed groups surging to the fore. We know that when a revolution really reaches decisive moments, it can start to break apart the armed forces of the state in unpredictable ways. And we know revolutions can involve workers' strikes, and that these strikes can spread rapidly. And we would argue that they should be spreaded rapidly. We see various combinations of these things right now in Myanmar. We saw them in 2020 in Belarus. We saw them in 2019 in Sudan. We saw pretty much all of those things happening in Egypt, both in before and during the 2011 revolution. But there's more we can say about strikes. I want to focus on them in particular, because it's one thing to have a series of strikes as part of a more generalized movement to overthrow the government. It's another step again for the striking workers to start conceiving of their actions as the means to, you know, start building a whole new social order. But even that enormous realization, you know, can actually flow quite easily from the situation. So as I mentioned earlier, one of the key questions facing the revolt in Myanmar is, what does victory look like? Is it just the military generals agreeing to hand some modicum of parliamentary power back to the same old bourgeois hacks in the NLD while refusing to relent an inch of their own power? And if they did that, you know, what would the military's revenge look like? So you can see the question there is a profound one. Then what would it take, though, then, to go all the way? How can a revolution actually smash the state and replace it with a new type of social organization, a new system that takes as its starting point a, you know, profound, thoroughgoing, expansive democracy, the rule of the masses over our own destiny rather than the rule of the powerful few over the rest of us? How do we get there? So that's why I want to look more closely at the role of workers' strikes in a revolution. Just imagine if the strikes that took hold across Myanmar earlier this year managed to really hold on and to continue to build. You know, they did for months, but imagine if they'd really spread out to, you know, most of the economy or the whole economy, shutting down the country's whole productive infrastructure. On the one hand, that would have been the strongest challenge that the masses could muster against the rule of the military junta, and it would decisively bring the whole situation to a head. On the other hand, it would also pose a very real problem for the revolutionary movement. Namely, how would people survive if the food is not being produced, if the transportation is not running, if the power and the water plants are on strike, if everything is basically brought to a screaming halt and it just stays that way indefinitely? In such a situation, there seems to be a standoff, with the ruling class and the oppressed classes staring each other down to see who blinks first. The ruling class has the advantage of being already in power, with laws and cops and prisons and bullets, and with the sort of more just established reality that you need a job if you're going to eat, you know. So they rely on all these things to break the back of the strike. But the workers have their own advantage, and it's a big one. Namely, they can do the work whenever they choose, and they don't need the bosses to make it happen. Think about it. For the strike to have spread that far in the first place, there must necessarily have been conscious organization by workers, not just of their comrades in their own workplace, but across workplaces, between workplaces, across industries, and even across cities and whole geographic regions. Even running a strike in one single workplace, if it's done seriously, compels the workers to sort of take on a degree of their own leadership, you know, to do something like electing strike leaders and strike committees. As the strike spreads, such committees themselves are compelled to organize more closely with each other, forming a network of strike committees. Such a network, if it forms, and we've seen this in many revolutionary situations, can begin to take on tasks well beyond running and spreading the strikes. When all of the ingredients are in place, the right ingredients are there, those kinds of networks of workers' committees can even start to establish themselves as the authority that controls a sort of, you know, like a sort of reboot of the workplaces, not under the management of the old bosses, those parasites who might own the workplace because, you know, they've got a bit of paper that says they own it and laws that say they own it, but rather under the self-organization of the workers themselves. We're talking about workers themselves choosing collectively to restart production, not for the profits of the bosses, but to ensure that workers are fed, clothed, have power, have water, etc. In short, to enable the working class to sustain its ongoing revolt against the ruling class. If the working class starts behaving that way, then they're actually beginning to position their own democratic organs of class struggle in direct opposition to the existing capitalist state. That is, they're throwing down the question of who runs society. In such a moment, the very basis of the capitalist class's power faces an existential threat. When the revolution in Russia reached that height, whole industrial workforces, even whole battalions of the army, began taking orders from the workers' councils instead of from the official government. It should be obvious to you when you say it like that, that that kind of situation can't go on forever. When it arises, one center of authority has to smash the other. Victory then would mean the workers' democratic councils and organizations sweeping aside the existing state and declaring themselves the new sole authority in society. And that is precisely what happened in Russia in 1917. It seems huge, right? And it is. It's probably huger than it even is seeming on paper here, right? When you think through it all, that's why we put so much effort into reading it and understanding it and getting to grips with it. But remember, there is a very real material basis to these developments. And that's why we see that same pattern time and time again in different revolutions. It all starts from the basic fact that capitalism has at its core an irreconcilable conflict between exploiters and exploited, a seething tension that cannot be resolved. When workers organize to defend their interests, even in the smallest everyday ways, they are actually encroaching on the power of the capitalist class. But at those times when the stakes are particularly high, when a revolutionary situation is taking shape, workers' resistance can throw up precisely those new organizational forms that suggest a whole new way of running society without capitalists. So Russia in 1917 might seem, you know, so long ago, right? But there are recent examples that we can look at and see elements of this. The 2020 uprising in Belarus involved mass strikes that began in the state-owned tractor factories before spreading to the other sectors, including teachers, television stations, and eventually becoming a nationwide mass general strike. Central to this was the formation of a citywide strike committee encompassing 20 of the largest workplaces in the industrial city of Grodno, and eventually efforts were made to form a nationwide strike committee. We have to say, it was a mixed bag, right? There was all sorts of rat bags, pro-capitalist, liberal-type figures in there, but, you know, it was something. We'll get to that in a second. Likewise, the striking workers in Myanmar earlier this year formed a strike committee to coordinate their actions across the country. Likewise, peppered with some opportunist rat bags who have no real interest in genuine workers' power. All of that is to be expected, right? The point there is that revolutions are messy affairs that arrive on the terrain that we don't, you know, we don't choose the terrain they arrive on. And the battles that that ensue take many forms. And there's a you know, one of the biggest battles is for leadership of the revolution. So how would workers take over their workplace in the first place? Well, one good case study comes from Greece in 2012, where the workers of Kilkis Hospital did exactly that. Amid a wave of mass strikes, economic crisis, and in the face of extreme austerity being forced on the population by the government, the hospital's employees, the nurses, doctors, technicians, orderlies, everyone, they'd been suffering repeated pay cuts. Many of them hadn't been paid a cent in over a month. So on one fateful day in February, they came together in an emergency mass general assembly of the workers to figure out what to do. And they decided to wield the only real power they had. And they voted unanimously to collectively take over the hospital. And they announced their decision to the world as follows. The workers at the General Hospital of Kilkis answer to this totalitarianism with democracy. We occupy the public hospital and we put it under our direct and absolute control. The General Hospital of Kilkis will henceforth be self-governed, and the only legitimate means of administrative decision-making will be the General Assembly of its workers. Keeping in mind our social mission and the moral character of our profession, we will protect the citizens' health, providing free care to people who need it. We call on our fellow citizens to show solidarity in supporting our effort. We call upon every mistreated citizen of this country to actively stand up against their oppressors. We urge our colleagues in other hospitals to make similar decisions. And we also call employees in all fields of public and private sector to do the same until our mobilization becomes a mass popular and labor movement of resistance and uprising, until the final victory against the economic and political elites that today rob our country and destroy the whole world. Again, I'm imagining your riotous applause right now. Now, needless to say, that was a bold move, and the workers' control of that hospital lasted just a few weeks before the government managed to reassert its control. But in that brief period, the workers of Kilkis Hospital demonstrated once again the central dynamic of workers' revolution. In the end, if the occupation of the hospital was to survive, it had to spread. For example, the workers who deliver supplies and electricity would also have to start providing that service for free, or at cost at least, and would thereby, you know, be drawn into the battle, would face the same struggle against their own employers. The hospital staff knew this instinctively, as any workers who move into serious struggle do. And so they called for solidarity. They urged workers in other sectors to follow their lead, just as the textile workers of Myanmar did when they went out in February this year. Throughout history, whenever workers have moved into this sort of serious and organized revolt, they have shown the same tendencies towards democratic decision-making and mass collective control over society. If the struggle at Kilkis Hospital had indeed spread along the entire kind of chain of production and distribution, then the mass general assemblies at Kilkis would soon have to have been accompanied by some type of organizing between and across those workplaces. Again, workers in past struggles have shown us how this is done. One of the most powerful examples comes from the workers' uprising in Poland in 1980 to 81, where workers from over 250 striking or occupied factories, striking and occupied factories, right across the city of Gdansk, joined together to form the Inter-Enterprise Strike Committee, with delegates elected from all the workplaces. Their example rapidly spread throughout the whole country, eventually uniting under one banner calling themselves Solidarność. Solidarność was essentially a counter-opposed government in Poland for almost 15 months before the Stalinist regime cracked down and instituted martial law. The Polish filmmaker Andrzej Wajda, who made a series of great films about resistance to the regime, observed the mood in the Gdansk shipyard while it was under workers' control. He describes it gives a deep impression of what he says, calm, coolness, festivity, something lofty and extraordinary. As almost every workplace in the country became part of that nascent revolutionary movement, an enormous change took place in the way that workers related to each other. One clearly kind of gobsmacked sociologist who wrote about it made the following observation. Much of the interpersonal irritation and aggressiveness has disappeared. People are being nice to each other. Even in the Arab revolutions, which never reached those heights of organized workers' control, people nonetheless displayed time and again their ability to govern themselves. In February 2011, immediately after the revolution spread from Egypt to Libya, a journalist reporting for The Telegraph summed up the mood of the revolutionary Libyan city of Tobruk. He wrote, "Cheerful chaos reigned. After 42 years of brutal dictatorship, no one seemed to be in control of anything. Yet somehow, everyday life continued. The power was on, the shops were all stocked, hospitals were open, and crime was not much worse than usual, even though the police force of more than 1,000 men have all deserted their posts. Traffic direction had been left to ordinary citizens who took over at key road junctions. Every afternoon, thousands of demonstrators gathered into Tobruk's central square, renamed Tahrir Square after the one in Cairo, to chant anti-Gaddafi slogans." What that slightly confused journalist described in Tobruk was new and exciting to him, but it actually echoes countless other revolutionary situations. It's not surprising that his report so starkly resembles George Orwell's report from 1936 upon his arrival in revolutionary Barcelona, where workers' committees were actually running the city. Here, the revolution was not just a sort of popular uprising like Libya, but one in which the organized working class had taken the decisive role, like Poland, but even more so. Orwell described it like this: "It was the first time that I had ever been in a town where the working class was in the saddle. Practically every building of any size had been seized by the workers and was draped with red flags or with a red and black flag of the anarchists. Every wall was scrawled with a hammer and sickle and with the initials of the revolutionary parties. Every shop and cafe had an inscription saying it had been collectivized. Even the boot blacks had been collectivized and their boxes painted red and black. Waiters and shop walkers looked you in the face and treated you as an equal. Servile and even ceremonial forms of speech had temporarily disappeared. The revolutionary posters were everywhere, flaming from the walls in clean reds and blues that made the few remaining advertisements look like daubs of mud. Down the wide central artery of the town, where crowds of people streamed constantly to and fro, the loudspeakers were bellowing revolutionary songs all day and far into the night. And he says, you know, ever the middle-class gentleman, he says, there was much in this I didn't understand. In some ways, I didn't even like it, but I recognized it immediately as a state of affairs worth fighting for. Above all, there was a belief in the revolution and the future, a feeling of having suddenly emerged into an era of equality and freedom. Human beings were trying to behave as human beings and not as cogs in the capitalist machine. I've read countless similar reports from witnesses to other revolutionary moments, including most recently Sudan in 2019. Whenever and wherever the masses have moved into conscious action to shape their own future, almost identical stories emerge. And there's a lot more to it than just, you know, civilians directing traffic. Mass revolutionary upheavals have a dramatic impact on the consciousness of those participating in them. Look at the Arab revolutions and the amazing sense of courage and confidence on display after decades of brutal dictatorship. Consider the now famous scenes of women and children leading the revolt in Egypt, or of Christians and Muslims defending each other from Mubarak's thugs. Everything that for so long seemed rock solid suddenly crumbles. All the divisive ideas and the sense that some of us are better or inferior to others, or that we ourselves could never change the world, all of this melts away. The masses in the Arab world in 2011 and that period were no longer just letting history happen. They were consciously intervening in a mass collective effort to make their own history. The effort, or the effect rather, that such action has on people's ideas is breathtaking. In a revolution, all the ideas we take for granted are up in the air. Everything is subject to radical change. The way we relate to each other, even in the most personal and intimate sense, is recast. In a society cleft into classes where one exploits another, oppression and division is a required tool of the exploiters. And the process of fighting to forge a revolutionary solidarity is instrumental then in undermining those ideas amongst workers. So I'm going to try to sum all this up. Revolution, as we've said, is a festival of the oppressed and the high point of the constant class struggle that we're in. Sometimes that struggle is hidden, sometimes it's obvious, but revolution is when the lines are most clearly and decisively drawn. All revolutions carry the potential to usher in a whole new society, not just to get rid of the sort of shitty aspects of the current one. Unfortunately, most revolutions do not reach that full potential. After all, it's not like we saw workers' councils and, you know, what that situation of kind of dual power and mass general strike emerged during the Arab Spring, for example. And even in Sudan 2019, Belarus in 2020, or Myanmar 2021, three revolutionary upsurges in the last 3 years, which have all involved significant workers' strikes and workers' organizings, we're still missing that key ingredient, that development of a nationwide network of workers' councils to run the struggle and to operate as an alternative center of power to the existing state. But all revolutions carry the potential for this to emerge, and hence to open the door for genuine human liberation on a mass scale. The question is, what does it take for revolutions to reach such heights? Well, one lesson that stands out most clearly in history is that a revolution will face many political challenges. These will come not just from the regime that we're aiming to remove, but also from among those who proclaim themselves revolutionaries. Such political forces will claim the existing system can be fixed, or just that, you know, the needs of the population can be met by installing new leaders rather than overthrowing the whole regime and smashing the state. In some countries, those sorts of forces are straight up bourgeois capitalist figures like the NLD in Myanmar. But frequently, they are also conservative currents within the workers' movement. Cast your mind back to Solidarność in Poland. The problem there wasn't that workers couldn't cooperate to run society, that they couldn't make a revolution. They proved in practice their capacity to do that. The problem was the existence of the capitalist state with its guns and its prisons, and the failure of the revolutionary leadership to address itself to the central question of overthrowing that state. In other words, it was a political failing, not a problem of revolution being impossible or that workers somehow were unable to run the world. Mostly because of the influence of conservative leaders like Lech Walesa, who acted to hold back the struggle at key moments, The national network of strike committees that constituted Solidarność never really grasped what they truly represented and never therefore took that decisive step that we had seen, you know, 70 years earlier in Russia. They never stepped up from organizing workers' control of production to consciously organizing an insurrection to disarm and remove the capitalist state, and hence the moment was lost. Here in Australia, any revolution is going to have to battle the forces of reformist social democracy, that is, groups like the Australian Labor Party and the trade union bureaucracy, as distinct from, you know, rank and file trade union members, which we all are. The ideological and organisational hold that these sorts of forces have over the general terrain of working class politics in Australia remains stubborn, even when their working class membership wallows at historic lows. We can predict firmly that such forces will work furiously to prevent any revolution going is what they deem, you know, too far. And hence, alongside the singing, alongside the dancing, alongside the joy, alongside the witty banners and the beautiful slogans and all of the heartfelt moments, alongside all of that, there is going to be a furious, ferocious, epic battle of ideas, of politics, of organization. And it will inevitably be a battle that requires force against the defenders of the old order. The ideas and the political strategies that win out in all this won't necessarily be, you know, the best ones or the right ones or the more correct ones, not even those that have the best chance of winning genuine human liberation. Rather, it will depend to a large extent on the sheer scale of influence that particular organizations wield. Ideas and opinions, whether they're brilliant or total shit, need to be expressed in organizational form in order to even throw their hat in the ring at all. And there will be all sorts of rat bags and moderates vying for influence. And that's one reason why we need a revolutionary party in advance, but that's a topic for a different session. So I'm gonna wrap this one up there and haven't even done any singing or dancing. I'm sure you're all heartbroken about that. So I'll finish there.